Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To listen without ads, head over to patreon.com/rightandwrong.
Ooh, a spicy question. I love it.
Because the writing is sort of everything, right? Like you can fix plot holes, but if the writing is
so some readers love that and some readers are like, but I wanted more of this. So it's kind of a gamble.
Hello and welcome back to the Right and Wrong podcast. On today's episode, we have a writer of epic fantasy, superhero fantasy and horror who, outside of her own fantastical worlds, also writes tie-in fiction for Marvel Comics and The Black Library, aka the Warhammer universe. It's Anna Stevens. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Let's kick things off, as we always do, with exciting upcoming news. Your ninth book and the concluding entry of the Songs of the Drowned trilogy is out on the 28th of March. Tell us a little bit about the trilogy, first of all, and also this final installment, The Dark Feather.
Sure. Okay. So this is my second epic fantasy trilogy. So there were some themes that I sort of found myself interested in during the writing of my first trilogy that I touched on a little bit. And so when it came to ideas for my second trilogy, I thought straight away, right, well, I want to talk about these things. I want to talk about, imperialism and colonialism, and I want to talk about how colonization happens, but also how it can be resisted and the fallout on both sides from those sort of cataclysmic events. So that was something that I was sort of really interested in. So I decided that I wanted to write a fantasy trilogy in which the evil empire is trying to take over the last couple of lands on this huge peninsula. The trilogy is the story of people on both sides of the conflict. So I love writing multiple point of view stories. I just love the freedom that it gives you and the chance to look at things from so many different perspectives. The cast, well, I mean, there's a cast of thousands because it's, they're sort of epic in scale. But there were six main points of view characters. In the first book, The Stone Knife, not all of them have actually survived to the third book. but we do still have some left. So it was really interesting to me to write about sort of imperialism and war and conflict from the point of view of the people defending their land and the point of view of the people trying to conquer it, and sort of looking at questions of, why would you want to do that? What is it you think you'd do? You know, all the questions for example, the British Empire, you know, they were like, well, we are bringing civilization to the savages and the barbarians and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, obviously that's just a load of absolute rubbish. What we were doing was going over there and stealing everything we could get our grubby little fingers on. But it was the way that they justified it from a moral and ethical and religious standpoint. You know, we are doing this for their own good. And I wanted to sort of wrestle with that question and see how we could approach it in like a fantasy setting. So that was sort of the main thrust of the reason for writing it. And then I wanted also to not write it in a very traditional fantasy way, you know, sort of medieval European-esque. So it's actually inspired by Central American peoples, so the Mayan and the Aztecs in particular. So it's all set in sort of this very lush jungle environment, which necessitated an enormous amount of research. And I hired a sensitivity reader, just to make sure that I wasn't, appropriating anything. So it's a very sort of lush, vibrant, jungle environment in which this epic war and the sort of the rise and fall and fate of nations is all played out within that sort of that sort of geology and geography.
Wow. Is there a big difference in technology between the invaders and the ones being invaded as was in the history of the real world?
There isn't actually. Okay. So it sort of started off with one people, sort of one land, and they were like, well, obviously our God is the only God and the best God and blah, blah, blah. And we are going to spread that message. And then, you know, they start creeping out one way and then the other until they're basically, they've taken over like 90% of this peninsula. But they're all very much of the same sort of technological level. It's because they're within the same environment. It's not, you know, obviously we sailed over to the Americas, and because of that distance with the ocean, the technology hadn't bled across. Whereas if you're sharing a border with someone, I imagine it's much more likely that that would happen.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned just then that there's a sort of religious element to this. Is there a sort of propagation of religion tied into the kind of reasoning for the colonialization or the justification for it?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. So the trilogy title is The Songs of the Drowned, which has a direct reference to the Empire of Songs, which has as its sort of supreme leader and magic wielder a person called the Singer. And at the end of each singer's life, they sort of transform into this water-dwelling creature who communicates via song. So to them, that is the you know, their sort of their God on earth then becomes a literal God when they pass on. But to all of the other peoples, these are just monsters that live in the water.
Yeah.
That are known as the Drowned. To people who don't believe, they're called the Drowned. So there's sort of layers of peril and threat, because these creatures have invaded every water source within the peninsula. So whether or not you believe in them, they might just choose to, a bit like crocodiles, you know, sort of surge up out of the water and gobble you up.
Okay. Wow. That's very cool. It sounds like a really cool, world that you've built up around that. And I know that you've written, you know, you said your second fantasy trilogy, but this is also, you know, you've written, as I mentioned, for like Warhammer and Marvel, yeah, all kind of fantasy settings. Is world building something that you're kind of like very excited by and motivated by?
Yeah, it's one of my great loves, really. I do. My first trilogy was very traditional fantasy setting. So I didn't really, apart from, you know, some sort of naming conventions and coming up with some weird gods and stuff, there wasn't a huge amount of world building. It was just, this is the sort of society everyone would recognize it from watching Lord of the Rings or Wheel of Time or whatever. But this one was so completely different and just not anything that I was sort of familiar with, that I spent probably a good 6 months just on world building, just to make sure, as I said, because it is based on Mesoamerica. So I didn't want to be disrespectful and I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to get anything wrong. So I had to, I sort of literally built it from the ground up, looking at the geology and the geography and then architecture and agriculture and hunting practices and all of that kind of stuff, just like hundreds of layers in order to build up a society that feels sort of really lush and vibrant and feels like it's a real living society with a sense of history and myth and culture. And I found like a really deep love of world building from doing that. It was very hard work. But I thoroughly enjoyed it, to the point where I actually now run an online world building course.
Oh, cool.
Which is like an eight-week course, and each week we cover a different aspect of world building. which it's suitable for fantasy science fiction authors. So, you know, whether it's set in space or it's set on, you know, an analog of Earth, there's something in there that learners can kind of take away from it. So yeah, world building is definitely one of my big passions.
But I'm guessing once you said you spent 6 months building this world, and I'm sure as you're writing these, you do make tweaks and things like that. But once you've got the world built, do you find it quite easy to just start writing the story because you've got all that kind of groundwork laid down?
I think as I'm going through the world building process, which is all tied into research for me. So I'll be looking at this is how they did stuff, right? So I need to incorporate that in order to make the world sort of feel realistic. But at the same time, I'll then be thinking, right, well, who could be doing that? So I start building up a picture of characters as well.
Okay.
So I'm going to sort of contradict what I just said now, because I tend to come up with characters first. So once I've got an idea of the characters and the main, so like I wanted to be writing a story about Empire, I will then go and do the world building associated with it. So I had an idea for a couple of different characters, one on each side of the conflict, what the conflict itself was. And then I came up with the environment to put them in. And as soon as I realized how much work it was going to take, I was sort of doing most of my work was then on research and world building. But as I said, you know, I'd be sort of slotting in characters or, well, you can do that. That can be your job. By the time it got to the point where I felt like I knew the world enough, I had sort of introduced myself to the characters as well. So I knew who I was then going to be writing about. By the time the world felt real, the characters felt real, mm-hmm. which was very useful. So at that point, I could just get started.
Okay. And I bring this up because I had a quick, I quickly went and looked up the release dates of your original trilogy, the Godblind trilogy, and I saw that they came out back to back. I saw the first one of this, the Stone Knight, the first one of this series came out in 2020. And I'm guessing that those would also have come out back to back had it not been for a global pandemic.
A global pandemic. Yes. Yes. Unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, just everything got impacted all at the same time, didn't it? And there were huge issues with the supply chain as well at the same time. People just weren't getting stocks of paper. So books couldn't physically be printed. So yes, they were intended to be out 20, 21 and 22. But that's just not how it happened. Which is a bit of a shame because I wanted to keep the momentum going because it is such a big story and they are quite chunky, hefty books as well.
Mm-hmm. When you write them, is it, you know, it sounds like there is, you know, you're doing the world building, you're building up the characters. I presume there is at least a vague outline or a plan going on. Do you write these as a sort of one complete story and then break it up into three? Or do you know that it's going to be like book one and then that's going to follow and you're going to figure out what book two is and then that's going to figure out what book three is?
So I tend to know the ultimate aim of each book and the ultimate aim of the series as a whole.
Okay.
Although in this case, the ending of book three took me by surprise. So hopefully it will also take readers by surprise. because I didn't quite see it playing out the way that it did. I'm a big fan of letting my characters sort of have free rein and do what they want to do and make sort of, my subconscious is obviously working away, but my character, you know, I'll be typing and what comes out on the screen is not what I intended my characters to do. And over many years of writing, I've sort of learned to let that happen and to not fight it and be like, well, no, you were supposed to go left and you've decided to go right, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But usually when that happens, it's because my subconscious is sort of 12 steps ahead and has already worked out that this is going to make for a better book or a better character arc or something like that.
Yeah, sometimes it's just you. I've been in the situation, I've spoken to authors who have been in the situation where they're like, yeah, I kind of planned out where something was going. And then when I got to it, I was writing it and I was kind of, I was in that kind of flow state. I was really imagining things from the character's point of view, and it just didn't make sense that the character would do the thing that I wanted them to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So in this trilogy, this is the first time it's happened to me to such a radical extent. But one of my characters who is lovely and adorable and such a good guy has taken a very unexpected path and has made a series of catastrophic decisions, and the character's entire story arc and fate have just gone in a completely different direction, and I did not see that coming at all. And wow. It was really, I sort of had to stop and take a breath and think, do I want to do this? You know, do I want to take this character? Because of the gap between books one and two as well, I was getting feedback on book one, and the feedback was all, I really like this character. So then I had to sit there and think, do I really want to do this? Because I'm risking my readers then thinking, that's not what I wanted to happen. I don't like it. I'm not going to read anymore, sort of thing. But yeah. In the end, it just felt so true to the character, but also true to these bigger themes of empire and colonialism, that I decided to go with it. And whether or not it ends up being a risk, we shall find out when the reviews come in for the third book.
Yeah. Well, I think with these things, it's just about whether it makes sense, right? It's what people always say about what makes a great twist is that it's unexpected yet inevitable. And if that's the direction that, you know, one of your characters has gone in, that people are like, oh my God, I'm shocked. But at the same time, of course, that was the choice that they made. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So that's what I'm hoping, is that the of course bit comes through. Mm-hmm. I think it has. I'm quietly confident.
Yeah.
But we'll have to wait and see.
So you're on your books, you've got some really great cover quotes, which compare you to the likes of one of my favorite all-time authors, Joe Abercrombie, as well as George R. R. Martin, Martin Lawrence. They're all discussed within the category of grimdark.
Yes.
Do you think of your style as very grimdark?
No.
Okay.
I mean, there was apparently a poll on Facebook some years ago about what was the most grimdark book ever written, kind of thing. And I apparently came second or third.
Wow.
which I didn't expect at all. I think what it came from was that I was reading quite a lot of darker fantasy when I was drafting what went on to be my first book, Godblind. And I was a huge Joe Abercrombie fan. And I don't know whether it was that it rubbed off on me, or it was just that I thought it does feel more real than some of the other sort of classic fantasy novels. And I always liken it to when the film Gladiator came out with Russell Crowe. And that was the first time we saw, I think, seeing that on the big screen at the cinema, that was one of the first times we saw, like, really up close, personal, what it was like being in an army, what it was like being in a battle, you know, all of the stuff when he was still fighting with the legions before he got captured, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it really changed cinema. Excuse me. I thought it really changed cinema in that it didn't sort of shy away from it. There wasn't, you know, people sort of falling down with a little red splodge on their coat and that was it, sort of thing. And I think that was something that was starting to happen within fantasy novels as well. And I just thought, well, it makes sense. You know, it does make sense to not shy away from these things. So that was the style that I wrote in. I didn't really, I didn't at the time even know it was called grimdark. And then all of a sudden I was being marketed as grimdark. And I thought, oh, okay, fair enough. I wouldn't say that the Songs of the Drowned trilogy is grimdark. I would say it's just much more epic fantasy.
Okay, right.
But at the same time, it is the story of a conquest, and there is a huge amount of war and fighting and battles in there. So, and yeah. I don't shy away from describing those in a realistic fashion.
And there's also, I think, another big element, because the other thing is there's, you can go online and you can see all the discourse about what grimdark even is and mm-hmm. like what it means. And I think another big part of it is the moral ambiguity and how a lot of these books live. And like Joe Abercrombie is a prime example. There's no heroes in Joe Abercrombie's novels. There's like kind of villains, but at the same time, they're not really. And it's, you know, that's kind of similar to Game of Thrones, George R. R. Martin, you know, they're writing human beings, I guess. That's what makes it relatable, I think, is that it's like, these are human beings and everyone's kind of in it for themselves, but everyone's living in this moral gray area. And I guess with, like you said, you have people on both sides of this conflict. You have people on the colonial side, the people who are doing the colonizing and the people who are being colonized. And I guess that in of itself is going to create a sort of question mark within the reader's mind of like, well, you know, these are both real people and they both have points that they're making.
Yeah, absolutely. That is definitely one of the hallmarks of my writing, because as much as we don't like to think about it, you know, 90% of the people who did the horrific acts of colonization were ordinary folk who went and settled there. Once the violence had passed, once the physical military conquest was over and done with, it was just ordinary people who had suddenly been told, go over there, you can carve out a life for yourself, you can, whatever you can hold, you can keep. And to a certain extent, why wouldn't you go and do that? Especially if you've been told that you are morally and physically superior to the people who used to live there.
Yeah. And you're being told by your kind of like religious and political leaders that like this is a good thing and you're going to be doing everyone like including the people there a service, you know, like the old bringing civilization kind of thing is preposterous. But I love that style and the thing you're talking about where you are looking at it from both sides. Did you watch Andor, the Star Wars series?
I did, yes.
I think they did that so well, where they had the officers of the Empire, who we all know from like decades of watching Star Wars stuff. It's like Empire is bad, but they had these people kind of working their way through this bureaucracy, and they were so human and real that you were kind of like, a part of you was, even though you knew that they were doing bad things, you kind of start rooting for them because you're like, I get it. They just have jobs and they're just trying to do their jobs well, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. And then you also, was it Stellan Skarsgård? So you've got him and he's basically organizing and running the resistance. He's a hideous human. He's a terrible person. He's quite happy to sacrifice his own people, complete innocence, as well as the enemy.
And he has that great monologue where he says like he uses their tactics and he's given up his humanity. And there's a poetic, I think, what did he say? He's like, he'll to try and create a sunrise that he'll never see or something like that.
Exactly. And that, you know, that to me is, that's what I was trying to sort of recreate with this trilogy, was that idea that, you know, some people know that they're doing evil, but they're doing it for the right reasons. Other people believe they're doing good and actually they're doing evil. At the end of the day, both of those people are just people. So I do like to make it in that respect. I want to make you like the bad guys and then hate yourself for liking them. that's sort of my aim, because I'm not in any way agreeing with anything they've done. But I think if you've just got a cardboard cutout moustache twirling villain, that doesn't make for quite as compelling reading or viewing or, you know, media consumption. But when you have that sort of uncomfortable moment of kinship with someone that you know is a bad guy.
Yeah.
I think for me, that is, I think that actually helps to drive home the point more than if they were just, you know, the big bad.
Yeah. I totally agree. And getting back onto, you know, and that's something that I do think people, well, for me at least, when I talk about something as being grimdark, a large part of that understanding is that I think it is that moral gray area. But getting back to the origin of grimdark, which I believe, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it's from Warhammer.
It is. Yeah, it's a famous Warhammer 40K. Line,
in the grim darkness of the far future, there is only war. And that whole genre has been pulled out of that one line from a Warhammer novel.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know a little bit about Warhammer, but a friend of mine actually works at Games Workshop and he's like an encyclopedia. Mm. So you have written tie-in for the Black Library.
Yes.
It wasn't 40K. It was Age of Sigmar, which is the high fantasy setting, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
And you've also written tie-in for Marvel Comics.
Yes. Which is the polar opposite in terms of light versus dark.
It's all heroic fantasy. There's clearly a good person and a villain.
Yeah.
How do you get into that kind of stuff, that kind of IP work?
I actually got contacted by an editor at the Black Library after my first trilogy came out, which I think because my trilogy was being marketed as grimdark, it wasn't, you know, sort of a stretch for them to think, well, you know, Anna might be suitable to write for us. So they got in touch with me and said, would you like to just write some short stories and see how you get on with it? And like with the whole approach to writing IP, and whether you like the setting and the sort of the constraints that come with it. So I said, yeah, sure, absolutely, let's give it a go. So they sent me two PDFs that were so big they broke my laptop, that had all of the lore and all of the history and like 9 million photos and all that kind of stuff. Absolutely fascinating. Could only open one at a time and it took about 10 minutes to open because there was just so much information in there. And I read, one was 40K and the other was Age of Sigmar. And I sort of read through the two, or parts of the two, I'll be honest, and decided pretty quickly that Age of Sigmar, because it is the fantasy version, sort of aligned a little bit more with where my interests as a writer lie. So I decided to go with Age of Sigmar. And I wrote a few short stories for them. So currently I've got three short stories. And then I wrote a novella called Trisethne the Unseen, which is about a witch elf. And then I wrote Gothgall Hollow, which is actually a Warhammer horror novel.
Okay.
So it's set in Shai'ish, the realm of the dead. But it is very much a gothic horror that has added magic and walking skeletons and apparitions and stuff like that.
Okay. That's so interesting. When you do this kind of thing, so like obviously they send you these just bodies of text that you need to look at. Do they point you in a direction and say, we'd like you to write in this specific like kind of setting or like with these specific characters? Or do they just say, here's some lore, go crazy?
To begin with, it was very much just go crazy, see what speaks to you, see what you want to write. So that was for the sort of the short stories. And then for the novella, they got in touch with me and said, we want to put together a portmanteau novel of three novellas set within a framing device, all about the witch elves, the daughters of Cain.
Oh, I see.
Do you want to do that? So I said, yeah, that sounds like fun. I'd never written someone who was such a pure psychopath and such a pure homicidal maniac, and who was quite clearly the villain of everybody's story. except her own. And then I had to sort of make her into somehow a sympathetic character. So I really enjoyed it sort of from a craft perspective, was how to take this person who has zero redeeming qualities and make you somehow understand her and engage with her and stuff. So that was really fun. And then for Goth Girl Hollow, my editor got in touch and said, we're setting up a horror imprint. Do you want to try a horror novel? And I was like, I've never written a horror novel. And she said, that's fine, don't worry. And they basically had a very broad framework of what they wanted the story to be. So it was much more, instead of just writing within the IP, it was writing to a very set list of instructions.
Oh, okay.
So they had the names of the main characters, what those main characters did, sort of, you know, like hunter, sorcerer, scholar, priest. And they had a very set idea of where they wanted the novel to go. And I'd never sort of written to something quite that stringent before, but I worked really closely with my editor. And it actually turned out to be a lot of fun because they were like, this is what needs to happen, but you tell us how you think it should get there.
Oh, that's cool.
So yeah. It was sort of like having a framework, but also having the room to play within that.
Yeah. And I'm guessing was this an editor at the Black Library, which is like Games Workshop's publisher?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct.
And presumably they were kind of double checking the law as kind of you were giving it to them to make sure that it didn't clash with like the pre-existing canon.
Yeah, very much. Very much so. So it was because I was like one of the characters, Edria, is a sorceress. And I was like, well, how does that work? Because doesn't every magic user get sort of hurried off to magic school sort of thing? Mm-hmm. And she says, yeah, so what we need to do is we need to keep that sort of very secret. And maybe that's why they live in this isolated little town. So there were ways around it. But if I didn't know something, I would just email her and say, give me a spell that she can use. Or, you know, is this how you cast magic in Shire, yeah. You know, that kind of stuff. So it was a very collaborative process and was a lot of fun to write. Oh, it's the only book I've ever written where my editor has come back and said, can you add more skulls?
Interesting.
And then it's, well, yes, if you wish, I will put skulls everywhere. So I did.
Can do. Okay, very cool. That is, I'm going to come back onto this in a little bit. But right now it's time for the desert island question. Yes, it's time. Anna, if you were stranded on a desert island with a single book, which book do you hope that it would be?
Okay. I am going to say, this is a quick Google search showed me that there is a book called How to Escape a Deserted Island by Samantha Bell. So I would probably choose that one.
Okay.
If that answer is not allowed.
Any answer is allowed. I've had some crazy answers.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'd go with that one.
It's risky. Have you checked the reviews on it?
I haven't. I mean, the book might just consist of there's no way off, you're dead, which would be the shortest, saddest book in existence. Other than that, I don't know, the complete unabridged Encyclopedia Britannica, because that would keep me going for quite some time.
You'd be so knowledgeable.
I would know everything. Someone would rescue me and 10 minutes later they would dump me back on that island because I'd be like, guess what I know?
Someone shut her up.
Yeah, please.
Amazing. It's a great answer. You can't really go wrong with just a massive bank of knowledge. You might go wrong with the one book that you Googled and didn't check the reviews on. So who knows?
Yeah. We'll see.
And that brings us to the extended cut, exclusive to Patreon subscribers. So anyone listening who hasn't yet joined the Patreon, please think about it. It goes a long way towards covering the costs of running this podcast. Well, this has been awesome. This has been really fun chatting. It's been eye-opening for me. I've learned so much about different IPs and things like that. And it's been awesome chatting about your writing and your world building and your books.
Thank you
so much for coming on.
No, thank you for having me. It's really nice to get to talk about the whole breadth of my writing. Rather than, you know, obviously with the Dark Feather coming out on the 28th of March, I am going to be doing quite a lot of talking about that. So it's nice to be able to just dip into the Marvel and the Black Library stuff as well.
Yeah, it's been awesome. And anyone listening, if you want to keep up with what Anna is doing, you can follow her on Twitter, Instagram, and Blue Sky at Anna Smith Writes, or just head over to her website, www.anna-stevens.com. To make sure you don't miss an episode of this podcast, follow along on socials. You can get the extended episodes a week early and ad-free on Patreon. And for more bookish chat, check out my other podcast, The Chosen Ones and Other Tropes. Thanks again to Anna, and thanks to everyone listening. We'll catch you on the next episode.